CBS Eye on the World, I'm John Batchelor. The book is The Next 500 Years, Engineering Life to Reach New Worlds. Dr. Christopher Mason, geneticist, computational biologist, principal investigator and co-investigator with NASA, and professor at Weill Cornell Medicine. All of that to get to the word engineering. It's a wonderful word. We've talked about editing DNA, but now we're talking about a cell that's alive and what is to be done with that cell. Chris, if I understand, and I quickly got lost, we're already in this process of taking cells and putting them to work in some fashion. What is important is we're doing this for space. What is it that we need to do with our cells to make them appropriate? We've talked about adjusting them for radiation. What else can we adjust them for?
We can do a lot of other tweaks and modifications to our cells. The biggest risks are just to survive, right? Once you address that at a tissue level, in a developmental level, you've made it to out into space, and then you get to a planet that maybe has only methane or only other strange, atoms or even elements that you can use for your biology. What if we could take lessons from other creatures? So, for example, I describe ways we can modify T cells to make the immune system even more precise, which we do in my lab now and have clinical trials on this. But what if instead of just tweaking our immune cells or making new versions of them, you can engineer the whole cell and change what's on the outside, change what's on the inside? What if we could also take, for example, like plants? So there's these large, we all look at plants every day. They're everywhere. They have chloroplasts, which absorb sunlight and convert it into glucose and food for their cells. What if we could do that for human cells? So I describe the formulas and the math behind how much skin you would need to have if you became a chlorohuman, which is about 2 tennis courts worth of skin if you just wanted to lay outside for 1 hour if you're hungry to get enough energy for your body. So I talk a little bit about those options, but then also learning from extremophiles who survive in high and low temperature or salinity or other stress on their cells, and then they can survive even in the harshest of environments like the bottom of the ocean. So we could bring those in as well.
We right now have hybrid cells that are put to work. Is this immunotherapy? Is that what we're talking about?
Exactly right. So one of the things that, again, I think people think like, oh, this idea of hybrid cells or engineered cells that we're putting into people seems like science fiction, that it is widely deployed. There are actually, at this point, over 1,000 clinical trials worldwide, which we actually just published a paper on, that are doing these engineered cells for cancer therapy, where you take the cells and you say, I want to convert this T cell, or sometimes a natural killer cell, and I want to change what it can recognize and have it then go after a cancer cell. And actually, what you can do is reprogram. These are called CAR T therapies, or chimeric antigen receptor T cell therapies, which the chimera means like the Greek tale of actually merging two animal species together. It's a true chimera where you actually have different proteins that are not normally on that cell. And modify them, you can grow them up and then infuse them back into the cancer patient to treat lymphomas or leukemias. It's being treated for actually over 24 different kinds of cancer, including solid cancer. So this is everywhere. It's all over the world. So you get this idea that it's something in the future or it doesn't happen that often or that commonly. It is globally distributed and extraordinarily successful. And so you can change what's on the inside of the cell or the outside of the cell, especially immune cells.
You begin your storytelling with the twins, the Kelly twins, Scott and Mark, one who spent 340 days, I believe, almost a full year in orbit, and his brother. And when Scott returned to Earth, you did repeated physicals on him, and there was a lot of damage on his body, a lot of damage that looked scary to me. And he's a brave man, and he wrote it out. At one point, he asked you, can't you just CRISPR this mutation away? Wonderful, wonderful conversation. I'll remember to ask you that, Chris, sometime. Can you CRISPR this away? However, what did we learn about adjusting the human body, not just for generational shift in the 23rd century, but for life on Mars, because that's imaginable now, a Mars colony? What can we do?
Yeah, a Mars colony shouldn't be too far away, maybe 10 years away. We should 10 to 12 years, and Chinese might get there before the U.S. does at this current rate, it looks like. So it's not that far away. And what we can do, and as you described the story in the book, I related a story during, we present the results to, it's like any clinical trial. You present the results to your patients, and you tell them how the research is going. And I described these mutations, and he said, well, okay, I've heard about CRISPR. Can't you just get rid of the mutations? And what's interesting is this was about 3 years ago when we first presented some results. And then I said, well, it's not ready yet. But I said, but someday, actually, yes. And I said, actually, I'm just starting to write a book about that because I was just getting going. And I said, I think in the future, this will be very possible. You could say we've sequenced what's coming out of even your urine or your blood and say, aha, we've seen a new mutation. Let's actually design something that would go and fix the mutation. The biggest challenge with that is just getting it to the one cell that has that mutation is the issue. But you can also target, say, just at your bone marrow, where you make most of your blood, for example. So, you know, these are a bit futuristic, but as evidenced by clinical trials today, where we're modifying current cells or even doing CRISPR in bodies for, you know, for diseases and curing them, it is possible to do.
Preparing a human being, our biome, for life on Mars, with the, what is it, about 38% gravity of Earth, radiation on the surface. Yep. The soil is unknown at this point. We don't know whether it has toxicity. We can speculate at this point. But also we're looking at reduced sunlight and the long-term effects of living on a planet, knowing that returning to Earth is going to be a challenge to your body. Perhaps you can't survive it. So are you looking at creating human beings that can only live on Mars and not return?
Ideally, no. We hopefully have it so they can have, we've built humans or modified systems that we give to humans and astronauts so that they could have as much planetary liberty as possible. I describe it in the book as cellular liberty. Like your cells ideally should be able to do anything you need them to do. They have the greatest capacity to actually give you functions. And the same thing is true of the bodies. If we've made people so they can, you know, are exquisitely modified, but they can never come back to Earth or even visit, I feel like we will have failed. I feel like there is a challenge before us that I think is surmountable. We can engineer cells to be plastic and adaptive, much like we do for cancer therapies, to change what they are doing and how they function, like, you know, with genetic and epigenetic modification methods, give you the greatest plasticity so your cells can survive on the most possible. And I describe that as a planetary liberty that we have to get as broad as possible.
There are inspirations here on Earth for you. They're called extremophiles. The list is long. Thermophiles for hot, psychrophiles for cold, radiophiles for radiation. The one I like best was polyextremophiles. In other words, an extremophile for all seasons. Is that a guide to what we can do with human cells as well?
It absolutely is. I mean, what's amazing is this discussion of, you know, could life survive on Mars, or will we find microbial life elsewhere in the universe? I think we at some point probably will, because everywhere we look on Earth, we found that microbes have pretty much adapted and found some way to survive, whether it's, you know, surviving really at the border of a hydrothermal vent at the bottom of the ocean, you know, crushing pressure, extreme temperature changes in salinity, but still surviving. And we've also seen that they can survive, you know, even at the rims of volcanoes or even sometimes in the atmosphere. Some species of bacillus and bacteria can survive in space, be radiated and completely dried out, and then bring back and grow them up. So we have a precedent. We know that life can be adapted to these environments. And I talk about going to Titan is that eventually you'd have to adapt to be able to use all the methane that's there and the cold temperatures. But we know something probably could survive there if we engineered it and took all the lessons of creatures on Earth and brought it to bear, at least for microbes and someday potentially humans.
Doctor, forgive me, but in reading your book, I made notes to myself about puzzles I have. Is it adequate under your understanding of deontogenic ethics that you're successful at creating life that can exist on Titan and Mars and beyond that is not human? Is that a success?
I like to say that I am towards cognition, I am matter agnostic. That means whatever the state of matter is that is creating cognitive and states and sentience, I'm okay with, as long as they subscribe, I think, to the deontogenic ethic frameworks, or that they are good, that they're nice creatures, whatever they're made out of.
I go to an example you give us, the silver foxes that a Russian team once taking generation after generation of a fox life, however that long is, and managed to find a way to make that fox a pet. That is a success. That would be a success on another planet within the memory of just a few decades, correct?
Yep. Yeah, it was extraordinary. It only started in the 30s. Within only a matter of about 40 to 50 years, they took all the foxes, the ones that were the most docile and calm, and only bred those. And the more angry and aggressive foxes in this Russian lab, they just kind of let die eventually. But managed to get it. So they became, foxes basically became dogs. Their ears began to get floppy. They began to trace human eye movement. And so they'd watch you, but their tails began to wag. They created dogs in a matter of really just 50 years. So if you guide evolution rather than let it drift, you can create complex new types of animals pretty fast. And so this is definitely something that we know is possible.
This is a joy, Chris. Dr. Christopher Mason, a geneticist and computational biologist at the Weill Cornell Medicine School. He's a professor. The book is The Next 500 Years, Engineering Life to Reach New Worlds. And when we come back, in my imagination, I'm going to ask Chris to take me on that generational ship, and we'll head out for another sun, hibernation, and dealing with the long wait, and robots, AI robots that take care of us, including making our own amino acids. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.